We have our own process. We compress the earth into bricks, so as to remove them without revealing what they are. But that is a mere detail. I have taken you fully into my confidence now, Mr. Heatherly, and I have shown you how I trust you. He rose as he spoke. I shall expect you, then, at Iford, at 11:15. I shall certainly be there. And not a word to a soul. He looked at me with a last long questioning gaze, and then pressing my hand in a cold, dank grasp, he hurried from the room. Well, when I came to think it all over in cool blood, I was very much astonished, as you may both think, at this sudden commission which had been entrusted to me. On the one hand, of course, I was glad, for the fee was at least tenfold what I should have asked had I set a price upon my own services, and it was possible that this order might lead to other ones. On the other hand, the face and manner of my patron had made an unpleasant impression upon me, and I could not think that his explanation of the fuller's earth was sufficient to explain the necessity for my coming at midnight, and his extreme anxiety lest I should tell any one of my errand. However, I threw all fears to the winds, ate a hearty supper, drove to Paddington, and started off, having obeyed to the letter the injunction as to holding my tongue. At Reading I had to change not only my carriage, but my station. However, I was in time for the last train to Iford, and I reached the little dim-lit station after 11 o'clock. I was the only passenger who got out there, and there was no one upon the platform save a single sleepy porter with a lantern. As I passed out through the wicker gate, however, I found my acquaintance of the morning waiting in the shadow upon the other side. Without a word, he grasped my arm and hurried me into a carriage, the door of which was standing open. He drew up the windows on either side, tapped on the woodwork, and away we went as fast as the horse could go.
"One horse?" interjected Holmes.
Yes, only one.
"Did you observe the colour?"
Yes, I saw it by the sidelights when I was stepping into the carriage. It was a chestnut.
"Tired-looking or fresh?"
"Oh, fresh and glossy."
"Thank you. I'm sorry to have interrupted you. Pray continue your most interesting statement."
Away we went then, and we drove for at least an hour. Colonel Lysander Stark had said that it was only 7 miles, but I should think from the rate that we seemed to go, and from the time that we took, that it must have been nearer 12. He sat at my side in silence all the time, and I was aware more than once when I glanced in his direction that he was looking at me with great intensity. The country road seemed to be not very good in that part of the world, for we lurched and jolted terribly. I tried to look out of the windows to see something of where we were, but they were made of frosted glass, and I could make out nothing save the occasional bright blur of a passing light. Now and then I hazarded some remark to break the monotony of the journey, but the colonel answered only in monosyllables, and the conversation soon flagged. At last, however, the bumping of the road was exchanged for the crisp smoothness of a gravel drive, and the carriage came to a stand. Colonel Lysander Stark sprang out, and as I followed after him, pulled me swiftly into a porch which gaped in front of us. We stepped, as it were, right out of the carriage and into the hall, so that I failed to catch the most fleeting glance of the front of the house. The instant that I had crossed the threshold, the door slammed heavily behind us, and I heard faintly the rattle of the wheels as the carriage drove away. It was pitch dark inside the house, and the colonel fumbled about looking for matches and muttering under his breath. Suddenly, a door opened at the other end of the passage, and a long golden bar of light shot out in our direction. It grew broader, and a woman appeared with a lamp in her hand, which she held above her head, pushing her face forward and peering at us. I could see that she was pretty, and from the gloss with which the light shone upon her dark dress, I knew that it was a rich material. She spoke a few words in a foreign tongue, in a tone as though asking a question, and when my companion answered in a gruff monosyllable, she gave such a start that the lamp nearly fell from her hand. Colonel Stark went up to her, whispered something in her ear, and then pushing her back into the room from whence she'd come, he walked towards me again with the lamp in his hand.
"Perhaps you will have the kindness to wait in this room for a few minutes," said he, throwing open another door. It was a quiet, little plainly furnished room, with a round table in the centre,
on which several German books were scattered. Colonel Stark laid down the lamp on the top of a harmonium beside the door.
"I shall not keep you waiting an instant," said he, and vanished into the darkness. I glanced at the books upon the table, and in spite of my ignorance of German, I could see that two of them were treatises on science, the others being volumes of poetry. Then I walked across to the window, hoping that I might catch some glimpse of the countryside, but an oak shutter, heavily barred, was folded across it. It was a wonderfully silent house. There was an old clock ticking loudly somewhere in the passage, but otherwise everything was deadly still. A vague feeling of uneasiness began to steal over me. Who were these German people, and what were they doing living in this strange, out-of-the-way place? And where was the place? I was 10 miles or so from Iford. That was all I knew, but whether north, south, east, or west, I had no idea. For that matter, Reading and possibly other large towns were within that radius, so the place might not be so secluded after all. Yet it was quite certain, from the absolute stillness, that we were in the country. I paced up and down the room, humming a tune under my breath to keep up my spirits, and feeling that I was thoroughly earning my 50-guinea fee. Suddenly, without any preliminary sound in the midst of the utter stillness, the door of my room swung slowly open. The woman was standing in the aperture, the darkness of the hall behind her, the yellow light from my lamp beating upon her eager and beautiful face. I could see at a glance that she was sick with fear, and the sight sent a chill to my own heart. She held up one shaking finger to warn me to be silent, and she shot a few whispered words of broken English at me, her eyes glancing back like those of a frightened horse into the gloom behind her.
"I would go," said she,
trying hard, as it seemed to me, to speak calmly.
"I would go. I should not stay here. There is no good for you to do."
"But, madam," said I have not yet done what I came for. I cannot possibly leave until I have seen the machine."
"It is not worth your while to wait," she went on. "You can pass through the door. No one hinders."
And then, seeing that I smiled and shook my head, she suddenly threw aside her constraint and made a step forward with her hands wrung together.
"For the love of heaven," she whispered, "get away from here before it is too late."
But I'm somewhat headstrong by nature, and the more ready to engage in an affair when there's some obstacle in the way. I thought of my 50-guinea fee, of my wearisome journey, and of the unpleasant night which seemed to be before me. Was it all to go for nothing? Why should I slink away without having carried out my commission, and without the payment which was my due? This woman might, for all I know, be a monomaniac. With a stout bearing, therefore, though her manner had shaken me more than I cared to confess, I still shook my head and declared my intention of remaining where I was. She was about to renew her entreaties when a door slammed overhead, and the sound of several footsteps was heard upon the stairs. She listened for an instant, threw up her hands with a despairing gesture, and vanished as suddenly and as noiselessly as she had come. The newcomers were Colonel Lysander Stark and a short, thick man with a chinchilla beard growing out of the creases of his double chin, who was introduced to me as Mr. Ferguson.
"This is my secretary and manager," said the Colonel. "By the way, I was under the impression that I left this door shut just now. I fear that you have felt the draught."
"On the contrary," said I. "I opened the door myself because I felt the room to be a little close." He shot one of his suspicious looks at me.
"Perhaps we had better proceed to business then," said he. "Mr. Ferguson and I will take you up to see the machine."
"I had better put my hat on, I suppose."
"Oh, no. It is in the house."
"What? You dig fuller's earth in the house?"
"No, no, no. This is only where we compress it. But never mind that. All we wish you to do is to examine the machine and to let us know what is wrong with it."
We went upstairs together, the Colonel first with the lamp, and the fat manager and I behind him. It was a labyrinth of an old house, with corridors, passages, narrow winding staircases, and little low doors, the thresholds of which were hollowed out by the generations who crossed them. There were no carpets, and no signs of any furniture above the ground floor, while the plaster was peeling off the walls and the damp was breaking through in green, unhealthy blotches. I tried to put on as unconcerned an air as possible, but I had not forgotten the warnings of the lady, even though I disregarded them, and I kept a keen eye upon my two companions. Ferguson appeared to be a morose and silent man, but I could see from the little that he said that he was at least a fellow countryman. Colonel Lysander Stark stopped at last before a low door, which he unlocked. Within was a small square room, in which the three of us could hardly get at one time. Ferguson remained outside, and the colonel ushered me in.
"We are now," said he, "actually within the hydraulic press, and it would be a particularly unpleasant thing for us if anyone were to turn it on. The ceiling of this small chamber is really the end of the descending piston, and it comes down with the force of many tons upon this metal floor. There are small lateral columns of water outside which receive the force and which transmit and multiply it in the manner which is familiar to you. The machine goes readily enough, but there is some stiffness in the working of it, and it has lost a little of its force. Perhaps you will have the goodness to look it over and to show us how we can set it right."
I took the lamp from him, and I examined the machine very thoroughly. It was indeed a gigantic one, and capable of exercising enormous pressure. When I passed outside, however, and pressed down the levers which controlled it, I knew at once, by the whishing sound, that there was a slight leakage, which allowed a regurgitation of water through one of the side cylinders. An examination showed that one of the india rubber bands which was round the head of a driving rod had shrunk, so as not quite to fill the socket along which it worked. This was clearly the cause of the loss of power, and I pointed it out to my companions, who followed my remarks very carefully, and asked several practical questions as to how they should proceed to set it right. When I had made it clear to them, I returned to the main chamber of the machine, and took a good look at it to satisfy my own curiosity. It was obvious at a glance that the story of the Fuller's Earth was the merest fabrication, for it would be absurd to suppose that so powerful an engine could be designed for so inadequate a purpose. The walls were of wood, but the floor consisted of a large iron trough, and when I came to examine it, I could see a crust of metallic deposit all over it. I had stooped and was scraping at this to see exactly what it was, when I heard a muttered exclamation in German, and saw the cadaverous face of the colonel looking down at me.
"What are you doing there?" he asked.
I felt angry at having been tricked by so elaborate a story as that which he had told me. "I was admiring your Fuller's Earth," said I. "I think that I should be better able to advise you as to your machine if I knew what the exact purpose was for which it was used." The instant that I uttered the words, I regretted the rashness of my speech. His face set hard, and a baleful light sprang up in his grey eyes.
"Very well," said he. "You shall know all about the machine."
He took a step backward, slammed the little door, and turned the key in the lock. I rushed towards it and pulled at the handle, but it was quite secure, and did not give in the least to my kicks and shoves. "Hello!" I yelled. "Hello, Colonel! Let me out!" And then suddenly, in the silence, I heard a sound which sent my heart into my mouth. It was the clank of the levers and the swish of the leaking cylinder. He had set the engine at work. The lamp still stood upon the floor where I had placed it when examining the trough. By its light, I saw that the black ceiling was coming down upon me, slowly, jerkily, but, as none knew better than myself, with a force which must within a minute grind me to a shapeless pulp. I threw myself, screaming, against the door and dragging with my nails at the lock. I implored the colonel to let me out, but the remorseless clanking of the levers drowned my cries. The ceiling was only a foot or two above my head, and with my hand upraised I could feel its hard, rough surface. Then it flashed through my mind that the pain of my death would depend very much upon the position in which I met it. If I lay on my face, the weight would come upon my spine, and I shuddered to think of that dreadful snap. Easier the other way, perhaps. And yet, had I the nerve to lie and look up at that deadly black shadow wavering down upon me. Already I was unable to stand erect, when my eye caught something which brought a gush of hope back to my heart. I've said that though the floor and ceiling were of iron, the walls were of wood. As I gave a last hurried glance around, I saw a thin line of yellow light between two of the boards, which broadened and broadened as a small panel was pushed backward. For an instant I could hardly believe that here was indeed a door which led away from death. The next instant I threw myself through and lay half fainting upon the other side. The panel had closed again behind me, but the crash of the lamp, and a few moments afterwards the clang of the two slabs of metal, told me how narrow had been my escape. I was recalled to myself by a frantic plucking at my wrist, and I found myself lying upon the stone floor of a narrow corridor, while a woman bent over me and tugged at me with her left hand, while she held a candle in her right. It was the same good friend whose warning I had so foolishly rejected.
"Come, come," she cried breathlessly. "They will be here in a moment. They will see that you are not there. Oh, do not waste us so precious time, but come."
This time, at least, I did not scorn her advice. I staggered to my feet and ran with her along the corridor and down a winding stair. The latter led to another broad passage, and just as we reached it, we heard the sound of running feet and the shouting of two voices, one answering the other from the floor on which we were, and from the one beneath. My guide stopped and looked about her like one who was at her wit's end. Then she threw open a door which led into a bedroom, through the window of which the moon was shining brightly.
"It is your only chance," said she. "It is high, but it may be that you can jump it."
As she spoke, a light sprang into view at the further end of the passage, and I saw the lean figure of Colonel Lysander Stark rushing forward with a lantern in one hand and a weapon like a butcher's cleaver in the other. I rushed across the bedroom, flung open the window, and looked out. How quiet and sweet and wholesome the garden looked in the moonlight, and it could not be more than 30 feet down. I clambered out upon the sill, but I hesitated to jump until I should have heard what passed between my saviour and the ruffian who pursued me. If she were ill-used, then at any risks I was determined to go back to her assistance. The thought had hardly flashed through my mind before he was at the door, pushing his way past her. But she threw her arms around him and tried to hold him back.
"Fritz, Fritz," she cried in English, "remember your promise after the last time. You said it should not be again. He will be silent. Oh, he will be silent."
"You are mad, Elisa," he shouted, struggling to break away from her. "You will be the ruin of us. He has sinned too much. Let me pass, I say."
He dashed her to one side, and rushing to the window, cut at me with his heavy weapon. I had let myself go and was hanging by the hands to the sill when his blow fell. I was conscious of a dull pain. My grip loosened, and I fell into the garden below. I was shaken but not hurt by the fall, so I picked myself up and rushed off among the bushes as hard as I could run, for I understood that I was far from being out of danger yet. Suddenly, however, as I ran, a deadly dizziness and sickness came over me. I glanced down at my hand, which was throbbing painfully, and then, for the first time, saw that my thumb had been cut off, and that the blood was pouring from my wound. I endeavoured to tie my handkerchief round it, but there came a sudden buzzing in my ears, and next moment I fell in a dead faint among the rose bushes. How long I remained unconscious I cannot tell. It must have been a very long time, for the moon had sunk, and a bright morning was breaking when I came to myself. My clothes were all sodden with dew, and my coat sleeve was drenched with blood from my wounded thumb. The smarting of it recalled in an instant all the particulars of my night's adventure, and I sprang to my feet with the feeling that I might hardly yet be safe from my pursuers. But to my astonishment, when I came to look around me, neither house nor garden were to be seen. I had been lying in an angle of the hedge close by the high road, and just a little lower down was a long building which proved, upon my approaching it, to be the very station at which I had arrived upon the previous night. Were it not for the ugly wound upon my hand, all that had passed during those dreadful hours might have been an evil dream. Half dazed, I went into the station and asked about the morning train. There would be one to Reading in less than an hour. The same porter was on duty, I found, as had been there when I arrived. I inquired of him whether he had ever heard of Colonel Lysander Stark. The name was strange to him. Had he observed a carriage the night before waiting for me? No, he had not. Was there a police station anywhere near? There was one, about 3 miles off. It was too far for me to go, weak and ill as I was. I determined to wait until I got back to town before telling my story to the police. It was a little past 6 when I arrived, so I went first to have my wound dressed, and then the doctor was kind enough to bring me along here. I put the case into your hands, and I shall do exactly what you advise.
We both sat in silence for some little time after listening to this extraordinary narrative. Then Sherlock Holmes pulled down from the shelf one of the ponderous commonplace books in which he placed his cuttings. "Here is an advertisement which will interest you," said he. "It appeared in all the papers about a year ago. Listen to this. Lost on the 9th inst, Mr. Jeremiah Hayling, aged 26, a hydraulic engineer. Left his lodgings at 10 o'clock at night and has not been heard of since. Was dressed in, etc., etc. Ah, that represents the last time that the Colonel needed to have his machine overhauled, I fancy."
"Good heavens!"
cried my patient.
"Then that explains what the girl said."
"Undoubtedly. It is quite clear that the Colonel was a cool and desperate man, who was absolutely determined that nothing should stand in the way of his little game, like those out-and-out pirates who will leave no survivor from a captured ship. Well, every moment now is precious, so if you feel equal to it, we shall go down to Scotland Yard at once, as a preliminary to starting for Iford." Some 3 hours or so afterwards, we were all in the train together, bound from Reading to the little Berkshire village. There were Sherlock Holmes, the hydraulic engineer, Inspector Bradstreet of Scotland Yard, a plain-clothes man, and myself. Bradstreet had spread an ordnance map of the county out upon the seat, and was busy with his compasses, drawing a circle with Iford for its centre. "There you are," said he. "That circle is drawn at a radius of 10 miles from the village. The place we want must be somewhere near that line. You said 10 miles, I think, sir?"
"It was an hour's good drive."
"And you think that they brought you back all that way when you were unconscious?"
"They must have done so. I have a confused memory, too, of having been lifted and conveyed somewhere."
"What I cannot understand," said I, "is why they should have spared you when they found you lying fainting in the garden. Perhaps the villain was softened by the woman's entreaties."
"I hardly think that likely. I never saw a more inexorable face in my life."
"Oh, we shall soon clear up all that," said Bradstreet. "Well, I've drawn my circle, and I only wish I knew at what point upon it the folk that we're in search of are to be found."
"I think I could lay my finger on it," said Holmes quietly.
"Really now," cried the inspector, "you have formed your opinion. Come now, we shall see who agrees with you. I say it is south, for the country is more deserted there."
"And I say east," said my patient.
"I am for west," remarked the plain-clothes man. "There are several quiet little villages up there."
"And I am for north," said I, "because there's no hills there, and our friend says that he did not notice the carriage going up any." "Come," cried the inspector, laughing. "It's a very pretty diversity of opinion. We have boxed the compass among us. Who do you give your casting vote to?" "You are all wrong." "But we can't all be." "Oh, yes, you can. This is my point." He placed his finger in the centre of the circle. "This is where we shall find them."
"But the 12-mile drive," gasped Hatherley.
6 out and 6 back. Nothing simpler. You say yourself that the horse was fresh and glossy when you got in. How could it be that if it had gone 12 miles over heavy roads?"
"Indeed, it is a likely ruse enough," observed Bradstreet thoughtfully. "Of course, there can be no doubt as to the nature of this gang."
"None at all," said Holmes. "They are coiners on a large scale, and have used the machine to form the amalgam which has taken the place of silver."
"We've known for some time that a clever gang was at work," said the inspector. "They've been turning out half-crowns by the thousand. We even traced them as far as Reading,
but could get no farther, for they had covered their traces in a way that showed that they were very old hands. But now, thanks to this lucky chance, I think that we've got them right enough. But the inspector was mistaken, for those criminals were not destined to fall into the hands of justice. As we rolled into Iford Station, we saw a gigantic column of smoke which streamed up from behind a small clump of trees in the neighbourhood and hung like an immense ostrich feather over the landscape. "A house on fire?" asked Bradstreet as the train steamed off again on its way. "Yes, sir," said the station master. "When did it break out?" "I hear that it was during the night, sir, but it's got worse, and the whole place is in a blaze." "Whose house is it?" "Dr. Batcher's."
"Tell me," broke in the engineer, "is Dr. Batcher a German, very thin with a long, sharp nose?"
The station master laughed heartily.
"No, sir, Dr. Batcher is an Englishman, and there isn't a man in the parish who has a better lined waistcoat. But he has a gentleman staying with him, a patient, as I understand, who is a foreigner, and he looks as if a little good Berkshire beef would do him no harm."
The station master had not finished his speech before we were all hastening in the direction of the fire. The road topped a low hill, and there was a great widespread whitewashed building in front of us, spouting fire at every chink and window, while in the garden in front three fire engines were vainly striving to keep the flames under.
"That's it!" cried Hatherley in intense excitement. "There's the gravel drive, and there are the rose bushes where I lay. That second window is the one that I jumped from."
"Well, at least," said Holmes, "you have had your revenge upon them. There can be no question that it was your oil lamp which, when it was crushed in the press, set fire to the wooden walls, though no doubt they were too excited in the chase after you to observe it at the time. Now keep your eyes open in this crowd for your friends of last night, though I very much fear that they are a good 100 miles off by now."
And Holmes's fears came to be realized, for from that day to this no word has ever been heard either of the beautiful woman, the sinister German, or the morose Englishman. Early that morning a peasant had met a cart containing several people and some very bulky boxes driving rapidly in the direction of Reading. But there all traces of the fugitives disappeared, and even Holmes's ingenuity failed ever to discover the least clue as to their whereabouts. The firemen had been much perturbed at the strange arrangements which they found within, and still more so by discovering a newly severed human thumb upon a windowsill of the second floor. About sunset, however, their efforts were at last successful, and they subdued the flames. But not before the roof had fallen in, and the whole place had been reduced to such absolute ruin that, save some twisted cylinders and iron piping, not a trace remained of the machinery which had cost our unfortunate acquaintance so dearly. Large masses of nickel and of tin were discovered stored in an outhouse, but no coins were to be found, which may have explained the presence of those bulky boxes which have been already referred to. How our hydraulic engineer had been conveyed from the garden to the spot where he recovered his senses might have remained for ever a mystery, were it not for the soft mould, which told us a very plain tale. He had evidently been carried down by two persons, one of whom had remarkably small feet, and the other unusually large ones. On the whole, it was most probable that the silent Englishman, being less bold or less murderous than his companion, had assisted the woman to bear the unconscious man out of the way of danger.
"Well," said our engineer ruefully, as we took our seats to return once more to London, "it has been a pretty business for me. I have lost my thumb, and I have lost a 50-guinea fee. And what have I gained?"
"Experience," said Holmes, laughing. "Indirectly, it may be of value, you know. You have only to put it into words to gain the reputation of being excellent company for the remainder of your existence."
The Adventure of the Noble Bachelor.
The Lord St. Simon marriage and its curious termination have long ceased to be a subject of interest in those exalted circles in which the unfortunate bridegroom moves. Fresh scandals have eclipsed it, and their more piquant details
have drawn the gossips away from this 4-year-old drama. As I have reason to believe, however, that the full facts have never been revealed to the general public, and as my friend Sherlock Holmes had a considerable share in clearing the matter up, I feel that no memoir of him would be complete without some little sketch of this remarkable episode. It was a few weeks before my own marriage, during the days when I was still sharing rooms with Holmes in Baker Street, that he came home from an afternoon stroll to find a letter on the table waiting for him. I had remained indoors all day, for the weather had taken a sudden turn to rain, with high autumnal winds, and the Jezail bullet which I had brought back in one of my limbs as a relic of my Afghan campaign throbbed with dull persistence. With my body in one easy chair and my legs upon another, I had surrounded myself with a cloud of newspapers, until at last, saturated with the news of the day, I tossed them all aside and lay listless, watching the huge crest and monogram upon the envelope upon the table, and wondering lazily who my friend's noble correspondent could be. "Here is a very fashionable epistle," I remarked as he entered. "Your morning letters, if I remember right, were from a fishmonger and a tide-waiter."
"Yes, my correspondence has certainly the charm of variety," he answered, smiling. "And the humbler are usually the more interesting. This looks like one of those unwelcome social summonses which call upon a man either to be bored or to lie."
He broke the seal and glanced over the contents.
"Oh, come. It may prove to be something of interest after all."
"Not social, then?"
"No, distinctly professional."
"And from a noble client?"
"One of the highest in England."
"My dear fellow, I congratulate you."
"I assure you, Watson, without affectation, that the status of my client is a matter of less moment to me than the interest of his case. It is just possible, however, that that also may not be wanting in this new investigation. You have been reading the papers diligently of late, have you not?"
"It looks like it," said I ruefully, pointing to a huge bundle in the corner. "I've had nothing else to do."
"It is fortunate, for you will perhaps be able to post me up. I read nothing except the criminal news and the agony column. The latter is always instructive. But if you have followed recent events so closely, you must have read about Lord St. Simon and his wedding."
"Oh, yes, with the deepest interest."
"That is well. The letter which I hold in my hand is from Lord St. Simon. I will read it to you, and in return you must turn over these papers and let me have whatever bears upon the matter. This is what he says. My dear Mr. Sherlock Holmes, Lord Backwater tells me that I may place implicit reliance upon your judgment and discretion. I have determined, therefore, to call upon you and to consult you in reference to the very painful event which has occurred in connection with my wedding. Mr. Lestrade of Scotland Yard is acting already in the matter, but he assures me that he sees no objection to your cooperation, and that he even thinks that it might be of some assistance. I will call at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and should you have any other engagement at that time, I hope that you will postpone it, as this matter is of paramount importance. Yours faithfully, St. Simon." It is dated from Grosvenor Mansions, written with a quill pen, and the noble lord has had the misfortune to get a smear of ink upon the outer side of his right little finger, remarked Holmes, as he folded up the epistle.
"He says 4 o'clock. It's 3 now. You'll be here in an hour."
"Then I have just time with your assistance to get clear upon the subject. Turn over those papers and arrange the extracts in their order of time, while I take a glance as to who our client is."
He picked a red-covered volume from a line of books of reference beside the mantelpiece.
"Here he is," said he, sitting down and flattening it out upon his knee. "Lord Robert Walsingham de Vere St. Simon, second son of the Duke of Balmoral. Arms, azure, 3 caltrops in chief over a fess sable. Born in 1846. He's 41 years of age, which is mature for marriage. I was under secretary for the colonies in a late administration. The Duke, his father, was at one time secretary for foreign affairs. They inherit Plantagenet blood by direct descent, and Tudor on the Distaff side. Ah, well, there is nothing very instructive in all this. I think that I must turn to you, Watson, for something more solid."
"'I have very little difficulty in finding what I want,' said I, "'for the facts are quite recent, and the matter struck me as remarkable. "'I feared to refer them to you, however, "'as I knew that you had an inquiry on hand, "'and that you disliked the intrusion of other matters.' "'Oh, you mean the little problem of the Grosvenor Square furniture van? "'Oh, that's quite cleared up now, though indeed it was obvious from the first. "'Pray, give me the results of your newspaper selections.'
"'Here is the first notice which I can find. "'It's in the personal column of the Morning Post, "'and dates, as you see, some weeks back. "'A marriage has been arranged, it says, "'and will, if rumour is correct, very shortly take place "'between Lord Roberts and Simon, second son of the Duke of Balmoral,' and Miss Hattie Duran, the only daughter of Aloysius Duran, Esquire, of San Francisco, California, USA. That's all.
Terse and to the point, remarked Holmes,
stretching his long, thin legs towards the fire. There was a paragraph amplifying this in one of the society papers of the same week. Ah, here it is. There will soon be a call for protection in the marriage market, for the present free trade principle appears to tell heavily against our home product. One by one, the management of the noble houses of Great Britain is passing into the hands of our fair cousins from across the Atlantic. An important addition has been made during the last week to the list of the prizes which have been borne away by these charming invaders. Lord St. Simon, who has shown himself for over 20 years proof against the little god's arrows, has now definitely announced his approaching marriage with Miss Hattie Duran, the fascinating daughter of a California millionaire. Miss Duran, whose graceful figure and striking face attracted much attention at the Westbury House festivities, is an only child, and it is currently reported that her dowry will run to considerably over the six figures, with expectancies for the future. As it is an open secret that the Duke of Balmoral has been compelled to sell his pictures within the last few years, and as Lord St. Simon has no property of his own save the small estate of Birchmore, it is obvious that the Californian heiress is not the only gainer by an alliance which will enable her to make the easy and common transition from a Republican lady to a British peeress.
"'Anything else?' asked Holmes, yawning.
"'Oh, yes, plenty.' Then there's another note in the Morning Post to say that the marriage would be an absolutely quiet one, that it would be at St. George's, Hanover Square, that only half a dozen intimate friends would be invited, and that the party would return to the furnished house at Lancaster Gate, which has been taken by Mr. Aloysius Duran. 2 days later, that is, on Wednesday last, there is a curt announcement that the wedding had taken place and that the honeymoon would be passed at Lord Backwater's place near Petersfield. Those are all the notices which appeared before the disappearance of the bride.
"'Before the what?'
asked Holmes with a start. "'Well, the vanishing of the lady.
When did she vanish, then?'
"'At the wedding breakfast.'
"'Indeed. Oh, this is more interesting than it promised to be. Quite dramatic, in fact.'
"'Yes, it struck me as being a little out of the common.
They often vanish before the ceremony, and occasionally during the honeymoon.' But I cannot call to mind anything quite so prompt as this. Pray, let me have the details.
I warn you that they are very incomplete.
Perhaps we may make them less so.
Such as they are, they are set forth in a single article of a morning paper of yesterday, which I will read to you. It's headed, Singular Occurrence at a Fashionable Wedding. The family of Lord Roberts and Simon has been thrown into the greatest consternation by the strange and painful episodes which have taken place in connection with his wedding. The ceremony, as shortly announced in the papers of yesterday, occurred on the previous morning. But it is only now that it has been possible to confirm the strange rumours which have been so persistently floating about. In spite of the attempts of friends to hush the matter up, so much public attention has now been drawn to it, that no good purpose can be served by affecting to disregard what is a common subject for conversation. The ceremony, which was performed at St. George's, Hanover Square, was a very quiet one, with no one being present save the father of the bride, Mr. Aloysius Duran, the Duchess of Balmoral, Lord Backwater, Lord Eustace, and Lady Clara St. Simon, the younger brother and sister of the bridegroom, and Lady Alicia Whittington.
The whole party proceeded afterwards to the house of Mr. Aloysius Duran at Lancaster Gate, where breakfast had been prepared. It appears that some little trouble was caused by a woman, whose name has not been ascertained, who endeavoured to force her way into the house after the bridal party, alleging that she had some claim upon Lord St. Simon. It was only after a painful and prolonged scene that she was ejected by the butler and the footman. The bride, who had fortunately entered the house before this unpleasant interruption, had sat down to breakfast with the rest when she complained of a sudden indisposition and retired to her room. Her prolonged absence having caused some comment, her father followed her, but learned from her maid that she had only come up to her chamber for an instant, caught up an ulster and bonnet, and hurried down to the passage. One of the footmen declared that he had seen a lady leave the house thus apparelled, but had refused to credit that it was his mistress, believing her to be with the company. On ascertaining that his daughter had disappeared, Mr. Aloysius Duran, in conjunction with the bridegroom, instantly put themselves in communication with the police, and very energetic inquiries are being made, which will probably result in a speedy clearing up of this very singular business. Up to a late hour last night, however, nothing had transpired as to the whereabouts of the missing lady. There are rumours of foul play in the matter, and it is said that the police have caused the arrest of the woman who had caused the original disturbance, in the belief that, from jealousy or some other motive, she may have been concerned in the strange disappearance of the bride. And is that all? Only one little item in another of the morning papers, but it is a suggestive one. And it is? That Miss Flora Miller, the lady who had caused the disturbance, has actually been arrested. It appears that she was formerly a danseuse at the Allegro, and that she has known the bridegroom for some years. There are no further particulars, and the whole case is in your hands now, so far as it has been set forth in the public press.
And an exceedingly interesting case it appears to be. I would not have missed it for worlds. But there is a ring at the bell, Watson, and as the clock makes it a few minutes after four, I have no doubt that this will prove to be our noble client. Oh, do not dream of going, Watson, for I very much prefer having a witness, if only as a check to my own memory.
Lord Robert St. Simon, announced our page-boy, throwing open the door. A gentleman entered, with a pleasant, cultured face, high-nosed and pale, with something perhaps of petulance about the mouth, and with the steady, well-opened eye of a man whose pleasant lot it had ever been to command and to be obeyed. His manner was brisk, and yet his general appearance gave an undue impression of age, for he had a slight forward stoop and a little bend of the knees as he walked. His hair, too, as he swept off his very curly-brimmed hat, was grizzled round the edges and thin upon the top. As to his dress, it was careful to the verge of foppishness, with high collar, black frock coat, white waistcoat, yellow gloves, patent leather shoes, and light-coloured gaiters. He advanced slowly into the room, turning his head from left to right, and swinging in his right hand the cord which held his golden eyeglasses.
"Good day, Lord St. Simon," said Holmes, rising and bowing. "Pray take the basket chair. This is my friend and colleague, Dr. Watson. Draw up a little to the fire, and we will talk this matter over."
"A most painful matter to me, as you can most readily imagine, Mr. Holmes. I have been cut to the quick. I understand that you have already managed several delicate cases of this sort, sir, though I presume that they were hardly from the same class of society."
No, I am descending.
I beg pardon?
My last client of the sort was a king.
Oh, really? I had no idea. And which king?
The King of Scandinavia.
What? Had he lost his wife?
You can understand, said Holmes suavely, that I extend to the affairs of my other clients the same secrecy which I promised to you in yours.
Of course. Very right. Very right. I'm sure I beg pardon. As to my own case, I am ready to give you any information which may assist you in forming an opinion.
Thank you. I have already learned all that is in the public prints, nothing more. I presume that I may take it as correct, this article, for example, as to the disappearance of the bride?
Lord St. Simon glanced over it.
Yes, it is correct as far as it goes. but it needs a great deal of supplementing before anyone could offer an opinion. I think that I may arrive at my facts most directly by questioning you.
Pray do so.
When did you first meet Miss Hattie Duran?
In San Francisco, a year ago.
You were traveling in the States?
Yes.
Did you become engaged then?
No.
But you were on a friendly footing?
I was amused by her society, and she could see that I was amused.
Her father is very rich.
He is said to be the richest man on the Pacific Slope.
And how did he make his money?
In mining. He had nothing a few years ago. Then he struck gold, invested it, and came up by leaps and bounds.
Now, what is your own impression as to the young lady's, your wife's, character?
The nobleman swung his glasses a little faster and stared down into the fire.
You see, Mr. Holmes, said he, my wife was 20 before her father became a rich man. During that time she ran free in a mining camp and wandered through woods or mountains, so that her education has come from nature rather than from the schoolmaster. She is what we call in England a tomboy, with a strong nature, wild and free, unfettered by any sort of traditions. She is impetuous, volcanic, I was about to say. She is swift in making up her mind and fearless in carrying out her resolutions. On the other hand, I would not have given her the name which I have the honour to bear. He gave a little stately cough. Had I not thought her to be at bottom a noble woman. I believe that she is capable of heroic self-sacrifice, and that anything dishonourable would be repugnant to her. Have you her photograph?
I brought this with me.
He opened a locket and showed us the full face of a very lovely woman. It was not a photograph, but an ivory miniature, and the artist had brought out the full effect of the lustrous black hair, the large dark eyes, and the exquisite mouth. Holmes gazed long and earnestly at it, and then he closed the locket and handed it back to Lord St. Simon.
The young lady came to London, then, and you renewed your acquaintance?
Yes, her father brought her over for this last London season. I met her several times, became engaged to her, and have now married her.
She brought, I understand, a considerable dowry.
A fair dowry, not more than is usual in my family.
And this, of course, remains to you, since the marriage is fait accompli.
I really have made no inquiries on the subject.
Very naturally not. Did you see Miss Duran on the day before the wedding?
Yes.
Was she in good spirits?
Never better. She kept talking of what we should do in our future lives.
Indeed, that is very interesting. And on the morning of the wedding?
She was as bright as possible, at least until after the ceremony.
And did you observe any change in her then?
Well, to tell the truth, I saw then the first signs that I had ever seen that her temper was just a little sharp. The incident, however, was too trivial to relate, and can have no possible bearing upon the case.
Pray, let us have it, for all that.
Oh, it is childish. She dropped her bouquet as we went towards the vestry. She was passing the front pew at the time, and it fell over into the pew. There was a moment's delay, but the gentleman in the pew handed it up to her again, and it did not appear to be the worse for the fall. Yet when I spoke to her of the matter, she answered me abruptly, and in the carriage on our way home she seemed absurdly agitated over this trifling cause.
Indeed. You say there was a gentleman in the pew. Some of the general public were present then?
Oh, yes, it's impossible to exclude them when the church is open.
This gentleman was not one of your wife's friends?
No, no, I call him a gentleman by courtesy, but he was quite a common-looking person. I hardly noticed his appearance, but really I think that we are wandering rather far from the point.
Lady St. Simon then returned from the wedding in a less cheerful frame of mind than she had gone to it. What did she do on re-entering her father's house?
I saw her in conversation with her maid.
And who is her maid?
Alice is her name. She is an American and came from California with her.
A confidential servant?
A little too much so. It seems to me that her mistress allowed her to take great liberties. Still, of course, in America they look upon these things in a different way.
How long did she speak to this Alice?
Oh, a few minutes. I had something else to think of.
You did not overhear what they said.
Lady St. Simon said something about jumping a claim. She was accustomed to use slang of the kind. I have no idea what she meant.
American slang is very expressive sometimes. And what did your wife do when she finished speaking to her maid?
Well, she walked into the breakfast room.
On your arm?
No, alone. She was very independent in little matters like that. Then, after we had sat down for 10 minutes or so, she rose hurriedly, muttered some words of apology, and left the room. She never came back.
But this maid Alice, as I understand, deposes that she went to her room, covered her bride's dress with a long ulster, put on a bonnet, and went out.
Quite so. And she was afterwards seen walking into Hyde Park in company with Flora Miller, a woman who was now in custody, and who had already made a disturbance at Mr. Durand's house that morning.
Ah, yes. I should like a few particulars as to this young lady, and your relations to her.
Lord St. Simon shrugged his shoulders and raised his eyebrows.
We have been on a friendly footing for some years. I may say on a very friendly footing. She used to be at the Allegro. I have not treated her ungenerously, and she had no just cause of complaint against me. But you know what women are, Mr. Holmes. Flora was a dear little thing, but exceedingly hot-headed and devotedly attached to me. She wrote me dreadful letters when she heard that I was about to be married, and to tell the truth, the reason why I had the marriage celebrated so quietly was that I feared lest there might be a scandal in the church. She came to Mr. Durand's door just after we returned, and she endeavoured to push her way in, uttering very abusive expressions towards my wife, and even threatening her. But I had foreseen the possibility of something of the sort, and I had two police fellows there in private clothes who soon pushed her out again. She was quiet when she saw that there was no good in making a row.
Did your wife hear all this?
No, thank goodness, she did not.
And she was seen walking with this very woman afterwards?
Yes, that is what Mr. Lestrade of Scotland Yard looks upon as so serious. It is thought that Flora decoyed my wife out and laid some terrible trap for her.
Well, it is a possible supposition.
Oh, you think so, too?
I did not say a probable one. But you do not yourself look upon this as likely.
I do not think Flora would hurt a fly.
Still, jealousy is a strange transformer of characters. Pray, what is your own theory as to what took place?
Well, really, I came to seek a theory, not to propound one. I've given you all the facts. Since you ask me, however, I may say that it has occurred to me as possible that the excitement of this affair, the consciousness that she had made so immense a social stride, had the effect of causing some little nervous disturbance in my wife.
In short, that she had become suddenly deranged?
Well, really, when I consider that she has turned her back, I will not say upon me, but upon so much that many have aspired to without success, I can hardly explain it in any other fashion.
Well, certainly that is also a conceivable hypothesis, said Holmes, smiling. And now, Lord St. Simon, I think that I have nearly all my data. May I ask whether you were seated at the breakfast table so that you could see out of the window?
We could see the other side of the road and the park.
Quite so. Then I do not think that I need to detain you longer. I shall communicate with you.
Should you be fortunate enough to solve this problem, said our client, rising.
I have solved it.
Eh? What was that?
I say that I have solved it.
Where, then, is my wife?
That is a detail which I shall speedily supply.
Lord St. Simon shook his head.
I'm afraid that it will take wiser heads than yours or mine, he remarked, and bowing in a stately old-fashioned manner, he departed.
It is very good of Lord St. Simon to honour my head by putting it on a level with his own, said Sherlock Holmes, laughing. I think that I shall have a whiskey and soda and a cigar after all this cross-questioning. I had formed my conclusions as to the case before our client came into the room.
My dear Holmes,
I have notes of several similar cases, though none, as I remarked before, which were quite as prompt. My whole examination served to turn my conjecture into a certainty. Circumstantial evidence is occasionally very convincing, as when you find a trout in the milk, to quote Thoreau's example. "'But I have heard all that you have heard.'
"'Without, however, the knowledge of pre-existing cases, which serves me so well. "'There was a parallel instance in Aberdeen some years back, "'and something on very much the same lines at Munich the year after the Franco-Prussian War. "'It is one of these cases that—' "'Ah, but hello. Here is Lestrade. "'Good afternoon, Lestrade. "'You will find an extra tumbler upon the sideboard, and there are cigars in the box.'
The official detective was attired in a pea jacket and cravat, which gave him a decidedly nautical appearance, and he carried a black canvas bag in his hand. With a short greeting, he seated himself and lit the cigar which had been offered to him.
"'What's up, then?' asked Holmes, with a twinkle in his eye. "'You look dissatisfied.'
"'And I feel dissatisfied. It is this infernal St. Simon marriage case. I can make neither head nor tail of the business.'
"'Really? You surprise me.
"'Whoever heard of such a mixed affair? "'Every clue seems to slip through my fingers. "'I've been at work upon it all day.'
"'And very wet it seems to have made you,' said Holmes, "'laying his hand upon the arm of the pea-jacket.
"'Yes, I've been dragging the serpentine.
"'In heaven's name, what for?
"'In search of the body of Lady St. Simon.'
"'Sherlock Holmes leaned back in his chair and laughed heartily.
"'Have you dragged the basin of Trafalgar Square fountain?'
he asked.
"'Why? What do you mean?'
"'Because you have just as good a chance of finding this lady in the one as in the other.'
Lestrade shot an angry glance at my companion.
"'I suppose you know all about it,' he snarled.
"'Well, I've only just heard the facts, but my mind is made up.'
"'Oh, indeed. Then you think that the serpentine plays no part in the matter?'
"'I think it very unlikely.
"'Then perhaps you will kindly explain how it is that we found this in it.'
"'He opened his bag as he spoke, and tumbled onto the floor "'a wedding dress of watered silk, a pair of white satin shoes, "'and a bride's wreath and veil, all discoloured and soaked in water.
"'There,' said he, putting a new wedding ring upon the top of the pile. "'There's a little nut for you to crack, Master Holmes.'
"'Oh, indeed.'
"'said my friend, blowing blue rings into the air.
"'You dragged them from the serpentine?'
"'No, they were found floating near the margin by a park-keeper. "'They've been identified as her clothes, "'and it seemed to me that if the clothes were there, "'the body would not be far off.
"'By the same brilliant reasoning, "'every man's body is to be found in the neighbourhood of his wardrobe. "'And pray, what did you hope to arrive at through this?'
"'There's some evidence implicating Flora Miller in the disappearance.
"'I'm afraid that you will find it difficult.'
"'Are you indeed now?'
cried Lestrade with some bitterness.
"'I'm afraid, Holmes, that you're not very practical with your deductions and your inferences. "'You've made two blunders in as many minutes. "'This dress does implicate Miss Flora Miller.'
"'And how?
"'In the dress is a pocket. "'In the pocket is a card case. "'In the card case... "'is a note, and here is the very note.'
"'He slapped it down upon the table in front of him.
"'Listen to this. "'You will see me when all is ready. "'Come at once, F.H.M. "'Now my theory all along has been that Lady St. Simon "'was decoyed away by Flora Miller, "'and that she, with confederates, no doubt, "'was responsible for her disappearance.' "'Here, sign with her initials, is the very note which was no doubt quietly slipped into her hand at the door, and which lured her within their reach.'
"'Very good, Lestrade,' said Holmes, laughing. "'You really are very fine indeed. Let me see it.'
He took up the paper in a listless way, but his attention instantly became riveted, and he gave a little cry of satisfaction.
"'This is indeed important,' said he.
"'Ah, you find it so?'
"'Extremely so. I congratulate you warmly.'
Lestrade rose in his triumph and bent his head to look.
"'Why?' he shrieked. "'You're looking at the wrong side.'
"'On the contrary, this is the right side.'
"'The right side? You're mad. Here is the note written in pencil over here.'
"'And over here is what appears to be the fragment of a hotel bill, which interests me deeply.
There's nothing in it.' "'I looked at it before,'
said Lestrade.
October 4th. Rooms, 8 shillings. Breakfast, 2 and 6 pence. Cocktail, 1 shilling. Lunch, 2 and 6 pence. Glass sherry, 8 pence. I see nothing in that.
Very likely not. It is most important all the same. As to the note, it is important also, or at least the initials are. So I congratulate you again.